our last case for argument, United States v. Abbas. Mr. Henning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Although the Hobbs Act's language criminalizing extortion under the color of official right has been around for almost 75 years, the statute has never been applied in the way the government asks this Court to apply it today, that is, to a person who is neither a public official nor acting directly in concert with one. There are two aspects of the district court's sentence today that I would like to discuss with you. The first is that the district court's unprecedented application of the Hobbs Act did not interpret the statute in light of its common law history, in accordance with the Supreme Court's decision in United States v. Evans. And the second is that the sentencing guideline, Section 2C1.1, which was applied, by nature does not apply to individuals who are not public officials.
But we start with the language of the statute, and it just says, under color of official right, which is a very broad phrase. And then if you are a fan of legislative history, it does seem rather clear that Congress thought that it was going to reach what we can call the masquerading cases, as well as the case of the police officer who goes in and orders somebody to do something that's ultra vires, beyond the scope of his proper authority.
I'd like to start answering your question with the language of the statute, which is where statutory interpretation should start. And when the court...
It's not true. Interpretation starts with knowing the name of the statute and what's it about. You never start with the language. You never cover the title and just read the words. They'd be meaningless.
Okay. Apologize, Your Honor.
Look, the problem I have, suppose you have a government official who says suppose I said to you, you know, I'm a judge, and if you give me $1,000, I will arrange for you to have lunch with the President of the United States. Now, I have no power to do that. That's not part of my office, but I tell you, yeah, judges can do that. We get to arrange lunches with the President. Now, you would agree that I would be violating the Hobbs Act, right? And yet, in that case, color doesn't mean I actually have authority to do anything, right? It just means that I am creating a deceiving impression of the scope of my authority, which is exactly what Abbas did.
Your Honor, because your situation would also be a violation...
In fact, the word colorable usually means, you know, not a colorable authority, but I don't have authority. So if you have to punish people for acting under color, it's you've defined the crime as being a crime of people who pretend to have authority that they don't have.
As the court said in Evans, if we had no common law history to guide our interpretation of the statutory text, the courts of appeals readings would be plausible based on the pure under color of language. However, the Evans court, interpreting this exact same language, went to the common law history, noted that it was meant to codify a common law crime and all, as Justice Frankfurter put it, of the fertile soil that comes with that common law crime and that interpretation of this under the color of official right language. And it intended to criminalize conduct of public officials who, as this court once put it in United States versus Meyer, sell their public trust. The harm, as shown by your example, is to the government and not to the bribe payor. The courts are not concerned with whether or not the bribe payor gets what he wants for his bribe. That's not what this crime...
I don't understand. Victims of extortion are not within the class protected by the statute?
The Hobbs Act is not designed to protect victims who attempt to bribe public officials, as shown...
No, but there's a difference between going up to a public official and saying, oh, yeah, you know, I'd really like you to do something for me. Here's $1,000. And having a public official say, well, you give me $1,000, I'm going to have you thrown out of the country or thrown into jail and so on. That person who submits to the extortion surely is a victim.
That person is a victim of the crime codified in 18 U.S.C. Section 912. I don't mean to imply that there is...
What are you talking about? You mean that if a person who has extorted is not harmed by a violation of the Hobbs Act? Good.
I'm saying that that's not the harm that the Hobbs Act is designed to prevent. The Hobbs Act is designed to prevent harm to the government. There are two important harms that the Hobbs Act addresses. Number one,
it seems to me the real harm from violating the Hobbs Act is to the citizens of the United States rather than to the government. What's the government? The government is the people. It's supposed to be.
Correct, Your Honor, and that's the idea I'm trying to express.
Taken down by corrupt officials. So they're certainly
and also the
protected by the Hobbs Act.
And the people who are governed by the public officials, Your Honor. So, first of all, the Hobbs Act is aimed to prevent someone from changing the honest administration of government and changing the way that they would act and sacrificing effective government in response to a bribe. But secondly, it's also
saying in the first half of the Hobbs Act that, well, we're not concerned about people who are robbed. We're just concerned about the robbers. That's very strange. Very strange way to think of a criminal statute.
Well, it is a crime in and of itself to bribe someone. It is not a crime in and of itself to be robbed. But the other important harm that the Hobbs Act is designed to prevent is, as is in the heading of the sentencing guideline at issue here, 2C1.1, the public's intangible right to the honest service of their public officials.
Well, can't the guidelines go beyond the statutory prohibitions and try to address other harms that are not necessarily criminal violations but bad conduct?
They could, Your Honor. In this case, because the relevant conduct was a violation of under the color of official right, if you find that by nature the defendant couldn't, my client, Mr. Abbas, could not have committed that crime, then the relevant conduct goes away and there is no reason to enhance. However, you are correct that the sentencing guideline in and of itself must apply to the situation at hand. And in this case, Your Honors, it doesn't. In the application notes, it says it applies to public officials. And it defines who public officials are. And the government's only substantive response is very circular. It says, well, you know, it says under the color of official right in the definition of public official, so therefore anyone who violates under color of official right must be a public official. That's very circular, and the catch-all provision to which the government is referring is by nature a catch-all. It's designed to catch people who are not federal, state, and local officials.
Did the judge St. Eve also discuss the 3553A factors of sentencing and talk about the seriousness of this offense and the distrust it caused people to have to government officials and so forth, and that's one of the reasons that she picked this particular sentence?
She did, Judge Tender, but there were two procedural flaws in her ruling given the guidelines range that she imposed. The first is that she did not start with the correct initial benchmark.
Yeah, but I think I mistakenly raised this issue with the previous case. I was thinking of this case, Judge St. Eve. I think it's a case of harmless error. I think she indicated her indignation at this crime. You know, when she says something, you call the FBI and falsely reported that individual is a member of a terrorist organization. Making such an allegation to the FBI in this environment is explosive. And she goes on, and I think there's no question she'd give the same sentence.
She did not start with the correct initial benchmark,
but
Your
we
Honor.
Do have a harmless error. If we're convinced from the transcript that the judge will give the same sentence, then we don't have to order a resentencing. This is a very light sentence he got. What, 29 months?
It's one below.
Very light. It's a very light sentence for this conduct,
it's
in my opinion. And I think in Judge St. Eve's opinion. Remember, she's particularly concerned about this business of false reporting of terrorism, sending the FBI in a wild goose chase about terrorism.
She is, Your Honor, but that does not increase the sentencing guideline in and of itself.
No, of course it doesn't. That's the whole point of Booker, and it's not sentencing guidelines. She's entitled to give a non-guideline sentence, and it just seems to me very clear that she would give the same sentence.
Her statement, in my mind, only goes to any defendant who committed a similar crime. It does not distinguish Mr. Abbas's conduct
from... It does. We don't have everybody running around reporting people as terrorist to the FBI. What do you mean?
And that was part of the conduct that was at issue at his trial and part of the conduct that she was sentencing him for, Your Honor. But she didn't explain her departure from the guidelines, and moreover, she didn't start with the correct range. The Supreme Court has held that this needs to be an official benchmark.
Because a judge is permitted to go outside the guidelines now, if it's clear that the judge thinks this conduct warrants this sentence, then it's just wasted motion to send it back to her.
May I? My time's expired.
Of course you can answer my question. You think I'd ask a question as the red light is going to be on to make sure that it's a rhetorical question is not answered? Does that make a lot of sense?
No, Your Honor. If she doesn't start with the initial benchmark, then the guidelines are not even advisory. They're not even an initial benchmark, and they are supposed to be. And secondly,
there's no harmless error rule in sentencing.
There is a harmless error rule, but the only time it's ever been imposed when the sentencing guideline was miscalculated that the government has cited is the Anderson case. And in that case, the correct guideline was the initial guideline that she started with. The court said the guideline should have been here. It should have been here for different reasons, but this is the initial guideline. And she's within the guideline. We're presuming that it's a reasonable sentence. And she doesn't have to give us reasons to depart from that. She's in the guideline.
Well, where's the error? There's no error there.
Correct, and that's why it wasn't remanded. It was harmless error.
My question to you was, are you saying there is no harmless error doctrine in sentencing? If the district judge gets the guideline wrong, there can't ever be a harmless error?
Unless the district court has given you ample reason on the record to support... I'm going to backtrack, Your Honor. No, I don't think that there is a harmless error rule when the initial benchmark is wrong.
What she said is different. This guideline business, I don't really understand it. If I'm wrong, nevertheless, this is the sentence I want to give.
She's using essentially two benchmarks.
That wouldn't work either?
No, Your Honor.
Isn't that the Anderson case?
I must have misunderstood your question. I apologize. Would you mind repeating the question?
If the judge says, even if I'm wrong about the guideline, this is the sentence I would give on the basis of, 3553A, would that suffice to make her error harmless?
No, Your Honor, because she, A, needs to start with the correct initial benchmark.
So there's no harmless error in sentencing, in your view.
If she doesn't start with the correct initial benchmark, correct. But even if my position is incorrect on that, she still has to justify her decision to deviate from what is the correct guidelines range. The guidelines range, which Mr. Abbas...
Now you're changing your position. Now you're saying there's no... Your position is consistent. No harmless error in sentencing. That's your position. Okay, thank you, Ms. Henning. Mr. Hauser?
May it please the Court, my name is John Hauser and I represent the United States. When the defendant used the outward show of official power to extort cash from his victim, and for what his victim reasonably believed was the defendant's corrupt exercise of that power, the defendant committed extortion under color of official right. We know that first and foremost from the statute's text.
Of course, there are lots of other statutes that use the phrase under color of law, and we don't apply them. So I'm thinking of 1983, naturally. And we don't apply them to every single person who goes around and says, I'm the building inspector, I'm the police officer. Indeed, the state action argument would be very strongly on the side of saying those people are not, in fact, acting under color of state law.
That's...
So how do we know which is which?
I'm not sure if I followed
well,
the last part of your question.
Why is that the correct interpretation for 1983, but it's not the correct interpretation for the Hobbs Act?
Well, there's a couple of different reasons, Your Honor. First, we know from the legislative history of the Hobbs Act that the Hobbs Act was Congress intended to apply the Hobbs Act to this situation. And
pretend I'm Justice Scalia, even though I don't look much like him. You wouldn't perhaps make that argument.
And you hate legislative history. The 1983 requires a distinguishing factor between 1983 and the Hobbs Act is that 1983 requires an actual deprivation of constitutional rights, which necessarily implies state action. And 1983 was enacted for a different purpose at a different time in our history to address state action in violation of individual civil rights. The Hobbs Act clearly applies to private parties in...
But isn't there another statute that prohibits anyway impersonating a government official?
There is, although the...
So why do we need the Hobbs Act to cover everything? Why not prosecute people who impersonate under one statute and prosecute people who are actual public officials committing extortion under color of official right differently?
The reason why is that under the impersonation statute doesn't capture all of the harms that this defendant caused when he engaged in the conduct that he did.
So maybe we need another statute, but I don't understand why, just because you found something that looks a little more capacious, it may be if under color of official right covers both masquerading and actual abuse of one's official powers, but it may not be.
Well, Your Honor, the distinguishing factor between what the impersonation statute and a garden variety impersonation case is that in this case the defendant represented himself as a corrupt FBI agent. He wasn't just impersonating an FBI agent. He was
pretending. A little late in the day for this theory of Hobbs Act. What? It's a century old, isn't it?
1934, I believe it was.
Less than that. Well, and still quite a 74 years is quite a long time. Have there ever been prosecutions like this before under the Hobbs Act?
I don't know the answer to that question.
This is a new idea of the Justice Department or the U.S. Attorney?
I don't know that it's new, Your Honor. I just don't know of any other...
There would be some cases.
Apparently we haven't even seen cases under the sentencing guidelines like this, because this is all about whether that cross-reference is appropriate.
If I could, there's two different
questions. Is that correct? No district court cases even?
I'm not aware of any other cases, Your Honor, with regard to the cross-reference. But I think the question is whether it's...
Isn't there a surprise factor? I mean, suppose you have a statute. It's been on the books for three-quarters of a century. It's invoked very frequently. And nobody's ever thought that it reached this particular conduct. Then all of a sudden the government says, oh, by the way, we can now charge these people under the Hobbs Act. Isn't that kind of unusual? And I say, I don't say it violates, right of notice or something, but it would surprise people. Kind of rabbit pulled out of the hat.
I don't believe that it would, Your Honor. Under the plain meaning of the text, it's
Mr. Well, I don't know. Plain meaning is so empty. What is a term like under color? It doesn't have a plain meaning. It's a legal term, right? Ask a person on the street what under color of official right means, they have no idea what you're talking about.
If there's a dictionary definition that makes it clear what under...
Really, a dictionary definition? You think people actually... You think non-specialists in federal law know what under color of official right means?
I wouldn't think that what ordinary person would, but I still think there's a plain meaning under
well,
the words.
Well, apparently there isn't, because the term appears in different statutes, and there doesn't seem to. If there were a consensus view that under color included impersonators, you'd have had a very different brief, wouldn't you have?
When would you ever charge a Hobbs Act violation? Or, sorry, when would you ever charge an impersonation violation if the Hobbs Act encompasses all of them and is a more muscular remedy?
I'm sorry, when would we charge an impersonation?
Yeah, why wouldn't you just sort of put that in the garbage bin because you've now covered it all under the Hobbs Act?
There'd clearly be cases where an impersonator would not fall under the Hobbs Act. One example is a case that was prosecuted out of this district where an individual posed as an FBI agent and was putting on seminars, and people were paying money to hear his supposed expertise about being in the FBI. Now, that money's not being extorted, and there's no specter of corruption in that case, even if people bought it that he was an FBI agent. No one's thinking that he's a corrupt FBI agent, which really makes it...
Why isn't he extracting money under color of official right? That is, he's saying, I'm FBI, I'm authorized to teach you how to protect yourselves or something, and, you know...
That individual's not using... He's not cloaking himself in the power of his office in order to demand
cash. I don't understand you. The power of his office is his authority as an FBI agent to give you authoritative instruction within the scope of his duties, right? FBI sent around to teach people how to keep themselves safe and for a modest fee.
I don't know why you're giving
that case away. That's your next step in your expansion of the Hobbs Act.
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. But it is distinguished.
In coercion into this seemingly plain term under color of official right.
I'm not reading a coercion element into it, Your Honor. I'm just saying that in the case that I cited, where the person's putting on seminars, he's inducing payment by virtue of his expertise. He's not cloaking himself under the authority of his office.
He's an FBI. He says, I've been sent by the FBI to instruct you in how to protect yourselves. It's our outreach program. I'm going to teach you how to spot a terrorist. It'll be very important for your company to have this expertise.
But there's no illusion that...
What does that have to do with undercover? I don't understand you.
There's no illusion that the FBI agent in your hypothetical, Your Honor, would use official power to fulfill a corrupt promise or in return for a corrupt...
His official power. He's pretending that the FBI has sent him to give you essential instruction in protecting yourself against terrorism.
He's impersonating, Your Honor, but he's not extorting in the sense that he's not using the... color of his office in order to demand the payment.
He's to extract money. I don't know why that isn't color of right extortion.
I'm not sure how I can answer the question any better, Your Honor, except to say that...
You have your own interpretation of what under color means.
No, we have a dictionary definition of what under color means. And even if...
What's your dictionary? Dictionary is that?
The Webster's Dictionary.
What does it say?
In 61. It defines color as...
61, did you say?
Yes.
Isn't that a little old for a dictionary?
Well, I believe...
I mean, I can imagine you could use 1934 with the Hobbs Act or 2008, but why did you pick 1961? The only dictionary in your office?
It was close in time to the... as close in time as we could get to the 1948 passage.
There were no dictionaries in 1948 or 1934.
None that were available to us, Your Honor.
Really?
The definition of color means an outward show, often concealing an underlying true character, and as a secondary meaning, a legal claim to or an appearance of right, authority, or office.
Well, that's perfectly consistent with my hypothetical.
Again, Your Honor, I guess we just aren't seeing it the same way, in that he's not using the
plain meaning. Your plain meaning just seemed to be a repetition of what the Hobbs Act says. It didn't seem to illuminate it.
Well, I'm not sure how I can answer your question, Your Honor, except to say that the text has a plain meaning. The legislative history, if there's any ambiguity about what the text means, the legislative history is directly on point by the statute's sponsor and namesake. And the harms that the statute is designed to prevent are the exact harms that the defendant caused when he acted in the way that he did, by posing as a corrupt FBI agent, cloaking himself in the authority of his office to demand an extortion payment.
He didn't have any office.
Oh, he cloaked himself in it. That's right.
Somebody else's office. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Hauser. So, Ms. Henning, your time had expired, but we'll give you a minute if you have anything further.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make two very brief points. The first going to Judge Wood's question, which was, what's the difference between extortion under the color of official right and impersonation? And I'd just like to point, Your Honor, to this language of 18 U.S.C. 912, which says, whoever falsely assumes or pretends to be an officer or in such pretended character demands or obtains any money. So I would submit to the court that there is no difference. The conduct was covered in 912. Second thing I'd like to cover is the suggestion that the legislative history is somehow more important because the quoted passage comes from Representative Hobbs. First of all, I'd like to point the court to Evans, where it quotes another statement from Representative Hobbs and indicates that it indicates his intention to...
Was he a senator?
Was he a senator? I thought he was a representative.
I don't know.
He's a congressman, Representative Hobbs. I'm sorry. He said that... the Supreme Court interpreted one of his statements to say that he intended this language to be based on New York law, which is, again, a common law that applies only to public officials. And that very statement to which the government refers has been looked at by the Sixth Circuit, who has found it cryptic, confusing, and unhelpful.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Hodgson. You were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Mr. Hauser as well. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow. Thank you.